all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to thank VetBiz Central, which is part of the U.S. Small Business Association, VBOC, Vet Business Outreach Centers. VetBiz Central covers Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, and can be reached at VetBizCentral.org. Let's move on to our programs. First up is a conversation that we had with a VA policy thinker and attorney, Rory Riley Topping, and we talked about the Trump legacy at VA as we move into the Biden administration. Then we're going to talk to a retired Army colonel. He argues that we are, as a country, fawning over our veterans, and we need to stop doing that. So I think you'll find both of these sort of provocative. They're pre-recorded. Sometimes it sounds not great in this instance, but I think it'll work out fine, and you'll enjoy the conversations. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Rory Riley Topping, a lawyer who's thought a lot about and worked in the veteran space for a long time. So we want to get some viewpoints of Rory's on a number of issues, including the legacy that Trump leaves at Veterans Affairs. Rory Riley Topping, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hello. Thank you for having me today.
Well, we're glad to have you on. An article you wrote in The Hill called Trump Leaves Mixed Legacy on Veterans Affairs caught my eye. And it's that time of year, right? We're transitioning from one presidential administration to another. So it's a good time to look back over these 4 years and see what, beyond maybe the hype, what President Trump was able to do in Veterans Affairs. You've been pretty busy in this veteran space, haven't you?
Yes, I have. That's, you know, I tell people, I don't live in D.C. anymore, but while I was there, I had the honor of working in all three branches of government and a national nonprofit to boot. So I feel like I did my full tour of duty throughout D.C. while I was there.
Well, and it's been recognized by a lot of different organizations, and folks have had you come and talk to them, such as the American Legion National Convention, and you've written in the American University Law Review Symposium. But mm-hmm. But let's back way up. How did you get started or interested in this field?
Well, my husband is a veteran, and my husband got out of the Army in 2006, which was before I was still in law school at the time. I graduated from law school in 2007, and he was not my husband yet at the time, but he went from the Army to grad school. He got a master's in public health at Harvard University. And even though he knew what he was doing when he got out of the Army, he knew he was going to school, the transition was still really hard. And this is somebody who, you know, he was a JAG, you know, he's a smart guy. He knew he was going on this public health track, that he was moving to Boston for school. And it was still just really, really hard. And we just thought, if this is hard for him, it's got to be really hard for a lot of other people who perhaps don't have their next step already set up for them. Perhaps don't know where they're going, what they're going to do for work, that sort of thing. So my husband's experience largely piqued my interest. And it extended from there, even after I had started working in this area. My sister-in-law, who is also an Army veteran, unfortunately passed away from, she's 100% service-connected and died at a young age from those service-connected injuries. So also having that experience in our family, just seeing what she went through and all of that, dealing with the VA, that's another thing that just made me feel like I work in veterans policy. You know, again, it was still challenging helping her navigate some of the care that she needed at the time. And again, if it's hard for me and I work in this space for a living, it just, again, resonates. It's got to be really hard for everybody else, and it shouldn't be. I know it's not that way for everybody, which is a good thing, and people's experiences vary across the board. But just based on those two close family experiences, that's really what's driven me to stay in this area throughout the years.
Well, it's interesting to see, I'm sure from your end, the difference between the policy and the practice. And that's that's a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. And before we move on to Trump's legacy and a couple of other topics, so as I've said to the audience and veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Rory Riley Topping, who is a keen observer of what's going on in the veteran space, both from a policy standpoint, but personal family interests as well. So let's talk about your view on the Trump legacy at Veterans Affairs. Rory, give us what you're trying to communicate in your most recent article.
So what I was trying to say in the most recent article is that really the legacy is mixed. And I started with the fact that Trump campaigned on veterans issues in 2016, and that was something that was really unusual. And for people who work in this space, myself included, I think it piqued a lot of people's interest. And again, I include myself in that category. There was a lot about Trump that was unusual at that time, but usually elections aren't won based on a candidate's position on veterans policy. So the fact that he made such an issue of veterans policy early in his campaign, I think that was something that was interesting to a lot of people, and whether they agreed with him on other issues or not, they felt heard for the first time, particularly veterans themselves who, you know, maybe for whatever reason were having an issue with the VA, were unhappy one way or the other with the conversations around access to community care, that sort of thing. So I think we saw that that really did make a difference in terms of helping propel him to the White House back in 2016. Now, in 2020, Trump campaigned with the slogan, promises made, promises kept. So that certainly made me think, did he keep his promise to veterans? And when you go back and go through just what he promised versus where we're at, as I said in the headline of the article, I think it's really mixed. On the one hand, early on in 2017, there was a lot of veterans legislation that was passed, and it seemed to be, for a period of time, the only bipartisan pieces of legislation that were being passed. And so, likewise, that was, I think, exciting to a lot of folks who are veterans or veterans stakeholders. However, from there, I think we see it was a lot of downhill after that, and we saw VA, as we've seen other government agencies, just get caught up in the political infighting that unfortunately has plagued a lot of departments throughout the Trump administration.
And as our listeners know, the VA is the second largest department next to the Department of Defense. It has a huge budget.
There's $220 billion last year.
Yeah, I mean, these are numbers hard to contemplate, and I'm not sure. It's one thing to pass legislation, it's another to implement it. And when you have things like Accountability and Whistleblower Protection Act, the Veterans Choice Improvement Act, the Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act, all getting passed, passing it's a real accomplishment, but implementing it is probably a bigger accomplishment, I would think.
I agree with that. And one thing that I say frequently is that legislation should be viewed as a starting point, not as an ending point. And I think one of the traps that Trump fell into was saying, oh, I passed legislation, I'm done now. Look at me, look what I did. And again, it's a trap because, as you say, implementing legislation is much more of an accomplishment than just passing legislation. And we all know the devil is in the details because once you pass this legislation, there are accompanying regulations that have to go through with it, and that's a process. We've got people who on the bureaucratic levels feel differently at the higher political levels. We've got the infighting that we discussed. So even though all of these legislative initiatives started out with a lot of momentum, as we saw in terms of them being implemented, they all hit some roadblocks along the way. So I think that was a mistake on the part of the administration, was to just basically congratulate themselves and say, look at us, we passed this legislation, instead of focusing on the implementation. They really needed to shift their focus after it was passed. And if they really wanted to change some of these policies, they needed to focus a lot more on the implementation than they actually did.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the, and it may be too soon on some of these to tell whether in the long term they're improvements or not, because it's only been a few years. But yeah, you definitely kind of have the sense that you stopped after you passed the act, but until we get rules, regulations, staffing, funding, you know, get this out into the field somewhere, I don't know if it's going to improve things or not. And anybody who's been watching the VA appeals through the Appeals Improvement and Modernization Act is still trying to sort out, is this better than it was? What was bad, so this is probably better, but you're still waiting to find out, aren't you?
We are, and I included a quotation in the article from recently retired Chief Judge Robert Davis, and he basically said that he viewed this legislation as a tragedy because we need bigger fixes, and the phrase that he had used was, this is just nibbling around the edges. And while I certainly agree with him on one level, on the other, having been a Hill staffer, I know that it can be really hard to compromise. And so sometimes what you get isn't designed to make anybody happy, but it's designed to give everybody a little bit of what they want. And quite frankly, I don't think that they could agree on a more substantial reform package than what we got. As you note, every time you talk about a big system like the appellate system, even though it's not good, sometimes people prefer the devil they know to the devil they don't know. And there's no guarantee that a new system is going to be better. I know you just referenced that you're a NOVA member. I don't know if you scroll through the NOVA listserv, but I mean, every day there's people talking about challenges that they're having figuring out higher level review and which lane to go in for claims. So I think that we're still figuring that out, particularly on the appeals front, and I think with some of the other pieces of legislation as well, it will be interesting to see. We've heard a few folks refer to appeals reform as what could be the next VCAA. And just to back up real quickly, that's the Veterans Claims Assistance Act, which was legislation passed in 2000, was designed to make the system better, but there was all sorts of unforeseen technical procedural issues that went along with that. And it basically stalled a bunch of claims significantly for a number of years while that was sorted out in court. And it ultimately went to the Supreme Court. Again, the legislation was passed in 2000. It didn't go to the Supreme Court until 2009. And then when that happened, after litigating it for more than 10 years, they basically ended up back to where they started. So there's some concern that this is going to be another VCAA where we're litigating the technicalities for a long time, and then we end up right back where we started.
Yeah, that's right. And those delays, whether they be in disability appeals or getting your health care taken care of, is part of what brought Trump to the forefront. But let's leave legislation for a moment and say that the legacy there is certainly mixed, and it may be too early to tell how if the implementation ever gets worked out right. And I wanted to switch to we talked about these delays, and one of the things Trump did as president say, well, you'll be able to call me and I'll get it fixed. And one of these promises about a White House hotline that would be answered, and it became out of it, didn't it? Because VA was doing such kind of a poor job of dealing with responding to veterans. So tell us how you view that portion of the legacy, which is a little more operational.
Well, again, I think it's another idea that was very well designed in concept, was a little bit more challenging in implementation. We saw with the hotline, I believe it's up and running now, but there were delays associated with that. It was not operational for an extended period of time after it was promised that it would be. So I think anything that improves direct communication between veterans and the VA itself is something that we should be supportive of. And that's one of the challenges with Trump, is because he's such a polarizing figure, you have people who just want to crap all over whatever he does and can't see any good in it. And then you have people on the other side of the spectrum who feel he can do no wrong and he's getting a tough shake from a liberal media and trying to just look at things with a more objective lens rather than a political preference. I think this is one of those things that he should get some credit for. I think that, again, anything that improves communication is a welcome change. But that hotline, like many of the other initiatives that we've talked about, it wasn't the smooth rollout that we had all hoped for. And I hope we keep it up and running. I hope that the VA continues to be responsive, particularly to veterans who are struggling and in need. But again, you can't just say you're going to do something and promise it without going a little bit further and figuring out how you're going to do all of that. And again, that's a consistent theme we see across the 4 years of Trump with VA, is he promised lots of big things, didn't necessarily provide the details of how he was going to do them. And so sometimes there was a disconnect between what was promised and what was delivered.
Well, I pulled up some information from the VA, you know, issues press releases and whatnot on these kind of things, and I didn't find a 2021, but in 2019, it claimed that over 250,000 veterans had called the VA White House, I guess I should call it the White House VA hotline. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it took a while to kind of get it going. Another example of what happens in federal government and big bureaucracies: promises are easy, implementation is hard.
Yep.
But they got this up, and they claim that hotline, the average wait time on that hotline was 9 seconds, and the calls typically lasted 15 minutes. And that if the call wasn't resolved there, it then, I guess, got put into, and they claim 94% of the cases were resolved. They put it into a VA client relations queue. It's sort of interesting. I've had clients who've said, well, I couldn't get through to my region. I called my congressman or woman, or I called the White House hotline, and things do seem to happen. When you call your congressman, sometimes, I don't advocate this all the time, but sometimes, and similarly, I suspect sometimes it worked at the White House VA hotline. Have you had any experience with folks who have actually used it?
You know, I have not directly had experience with folks who have used it, but I work with an organization here in Ohio called the Resurrecting Lives Foundation, which specializes in rehabilitating veterans who suffer from TBI. And I know through my work with RLF that we've received phone calls from a number of veterans who've said that they've called this hotline and not received the help that they needed. With regard to the VA's press releases, I feel, based on my experience working on the Hill, that I am always a little bit skeptical of VA's own numbers that they put out. So even though they're saying 94% of cases were resolved, VA is not very good at self-policing itself. And I think, you know, having worked on the appeals side, VA often says that their decisions from the Board of Veterans Appeals have very high accuracy rate in the 90-some-odd percentile, but yet, you know, half of these cases get remanded from the court. So there's always some discrepancy in the way that VA views and reports the statistics, and I think that's important. And I know it's something that we've been working on here in Ohio. RLF is actually partnering with Ohio State to look into these hotlines and do an academic study to see how, just an independent view of how responsive some of these the VA is in some of these cases, and if they really are meeting that 94% mark that they're meeting. So I would share that to say veterans here in Ohio have been skeptical, but on the flip side, veterans who are happy and receiving help probably aren't going to call an organization like RLF to complain. So there is a little bit of bias there in that, you know, you're not calling other organizations if your case has been resolved. But I think this highlights the fact that not everybody is getting the help they need from the hotline. It's not 100% successful at this point.
Oh, clearly not. And that's why I prefaced where the data came from. You always kind of have to look at it a little different when it's somebody who's reporting it in their own interest. But I think it goes to an issue that you talk about in your article, and that's the kind of relationship between Trump, VA, and the press, and the sort of impact or legacy of that. Would you like to elaborate on that?
Sure. So I think that the legacy of Trump and the press in general is, you know, we could do several episodes about that. And I think the media has always struggled a little bit with how to cover Trump because he just doesn't do things the way that most politicians and presidents in the past have behaved. So that's always been a struggle. With that being said, how the Trump administration operates their media has been a challenge on the VA front because they've basically closed themselves off. I mean, I know from working on the Hill during the Obama administration that the VA press shop has never been perfect. This isn't to say, you know, this is all Trump's fault. There have been issues with past administrations as well. But since the Trump administration, they've gotten a whole lot more walled off. And from reporters that I've spoken to, they feel like there's this really a much greater effort to control the narrative, which is very frustrating to a lot of people. I know one investigative reporter said that VA stopped responding to him altogether, and even when they provide a quotation that's critical of the crux of an article, having VA's input makes the piece better. And it just, over time, has gotten worse and worse, and most reporters are saying that they struggle to get any information out of the VA. We've seen this most recently with the coronavirus. There's a period of time where they just stopped reporting the data altogether in terms of number of cases, number of deaths, that sort of thing. And it's frustrating to a lot of people. Obviously, when we talk about government agencies, we talk a lot about concepts like trust and transparency. And when you have a press shop that isn't willing to give you any indication of trust and transparency, it's very, very frustrating. And I think it hasn't improved the situation. And I also think that people generally, while they are frustrated when things don't work, they appreciate a good apology and honesty. And when people come out, not people per se, but, you know, spokespeople for the agency say, hey, we're working on it. You know, we hit this hiccup. There's some level of respect for admitting that there are mistakes along the way, as opposed to just trying to sweep them all under the rug. And that's what we've not seen from this administration, is even though people like to bash the VA or whichever department when they make those mistakes, we all know that they happen. And rather than admitting that they're having challenges with some of the legislative implementation or whatever else along the way we're seeing right now, just with personnel and the recent OIG report about Secretary Wilkie, just the VA just has its own narrative in mind. And that's unfortunately not helpful. This is at the end of the day, this isn't an agency that's supposed to be about Trump and his legacy. It's supposed to be about helping veterans. And it just, based on the way that the press shop operates, it feels like they've lost sight of that and that their priority is protecting Trump, not working in the best interest of veterans. And I think that's just something that's really, really disappointing to a lot of people.
So I think that discussion with Rory Riley Tapping puts in perspective the last administration, the Trump administration, and how it made some forward progress relative to veteran issues, but fell short on other issues. And as we move into the Biden administration and new secretary, in fact, Secretary McDonough has one of only two secretaries of the VA who have not served. He's not a veteran himself. It'll be interesting to see how the new administration measures up and what legacy it may leave behind at VA. So I hope you enjoyed that. As I said, we've got another interesting interview coming up with Colonel Greg Dattis, a PhD professor of history type who has opined that America fawns on its veterans. So stick around after these words from our sponsor to hear his views on what maybe the country's doing wrong in that regards.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative? Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Are you a veteran or a military spouse interested in starting or growing an existing business? Then you want to connect with VetBiz Central, Michigan's only veteran business resource center, providing free one-on-one business counseling services, including research plans and preparing veterans to be lender ready. If you're in business, VetBiz Central offers comprehensive strategic marketing strategies to help you connect to corporations. They are one of 20 centers nationwide devoted to veteran business development through the U.S. Small Business Administration Office of Veteran Business Development. Vets helping vets. Visit their website at VetBizCentral.org or call 810-767-VETS.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today a Army Colonel retired, historian, author, opinion piece writer, Gregory Dennis, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, Colonel, you wrote an opinion piece, the title of which was America's Military Reckoning. It's time to stop the ritualistic fawning over veterans. But before we do, tell us a little bit about your story. How did a nice boy from New Jersey like you end up at the military academy, going on to get a law career, a PhD, and become this noted historian and author?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to grow up in the Garden State, God's country. and actually, we didn't have a lot of military background in my family. My father had served in the Air Force for just a few years after high school. And it really was my first introduction was a cadet visiting our high school during Thanksgiving break when I was in, I believe, a junior in high school. And it was my first kind of introduction to what West Point was and what it offered. And quite frankly, it offered me an education that I quite simply couldn't afford at the time at that level. And so, I think I went into West Point with for probably certain monetary reasons more than anything else to look to get that kind of education. And then over time just became, fell more and more in love with being in the Army and just never really had a reason to look back after that. So,
well, that's how 26 years creeps up on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
and Colonel, over that time you had assignments overseas. Tell us a little bit about your military career.
Yeah, I commissioned as an armor officer. I served in cavalry units for the bulk of my career. I served in Desert Storm as a tank platoon leader with the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, and then served in a number of assignments in cavalry units, both in the United States and overseas. And during the career, I was very fortunate to kind of move back and forth between field assignments and other assignments that allowed me to get a graduate level degree and ultimately a PhD that gave me an opportunity to go back to West Point and serve in the history department there. And really some of the best years I had in the Army were teaching cadets and being around them and being part of the career development process of some great young Americans who were at the academy. And I was very fortunate to be part of their professional development and show them, I think, how important history is and having an understanding of not just military history, but I think American and global history and why that's so important to successful officership. And then was fortunate after retiring to land a job at Chapman University, teaching in their New War and Society program. And then after 5 years, was happy to get another opportunity at San Diego State University, directing their brand new Center for War and Society.
You just wanted that better weather, so you can't argue with that. But I think it's important. I think people don't realize the diverse career paths military officers can have, and you're a good example of it. I actually have a friend who's a colonel in the Air Force who flew spy planes over in Afghanistan, came back to the Air Force Academy and taught English of all things,
right.
and is currently a White House fellow. I mean, this is there's a lot of opportunity for the young men and women who service, and I think sometimes we don't talk about that enough. And I'm glad you expanded on sort of your opportunity for just
Absolutely. I never considered the possibility when I was in high school that an Army career would allow me to earn a master's degree and then a PhD and to teach history, as well as serve in, you know, combat arms branch units and across the Army. So there is a lot of diversity in terms of career paths and what the Army offers, not just in terms of professional development opportunities, but also educational ones as well.
And it must have fueled in you some passion for not only the history, but for writing. I should mention to our veteran radio listeners that Gregory Dattis, retired Army colonel, is also a published author. I think there are 5 books up on your Amazon site that you've written. But that takes a certain amount of passion to put that much effort into writing that many words. How did that passion grow for you?
I think a lot of it spurred from my Army career. I had, I'm a historian of the American War in Vietnam, and while I was a cadet at West Point, I still remember having instructors there that were Vietnam veterans themselves. So I was still in that period where I was serving, in some cases, alongside Vietnam veterans. When we went to Desert Storm, I had in our scout platoon, in our cavalry troop, a few veterans from the latter portion of the American War in Vietnam. And so I think that's where the passion for telling that story came from. I grew up in an Army that was still wrestling with the outcome of the American War in Vietnam and trying to figure out what it meant and why it unfolded the way it did. And I thought that I had had a story to tell about the Army's experience in Vietnam and how some of the scholarship I thought may have gotten it wrong based on what I was seeing as I was doing more reading and getting into some of the primary source material.
You are a bit of a bridge from that era to this Iraq-Afghan endless war era. Greg, when did you get out of the Army?
2015.
So as I say, there's that bridge that you are between those eras for the Army, and it's sort of interesting because it maybe that shapes a little bit about the opinion piece that you wrote that I want to talk about. Why don't you explain to our listeners the article that you wrote in late December in Salon magazine, or it's a web magazine, but that captured a lot of attention and a little bit of buzz. So
right.
tell us what you were thinking.
I think mostly it was I wanted to tell a cautionary tale that we need to be really careful about how we treat and talk about veterans of the armed forces. And this is no way, there's no way to disparage, or I didn't want to disparage veterans, and clearly I am one. But I think over time in the post-Vietnam era, and I do think there is a linkage between our experiences in Vietnam and today, that the pendulum has kind of swung so far to the other side where I think many Americans coming out of the Vietnam era felt some guilt about how they treated our veterans. And as a way to kind of reconcile that guilt, I think many Americans now have kind of gone too far to the other side, where all they do is thank veterans for their service and aren't willing to be critical about some veterans who speak out in improper ways. And I think it was when I started seeing the commentary from retired lieutenant generals like Michael Flynn and Thomas McInerney, who were quite literally calling for the president to declare martial law because they didn't agree with a free and fair election. And there wasn't enough veterans that were speaking out against this, that I thought I needed to say something about our uncritical adulation of veterans. And that blanket adulation, as I argued in the article, I think really needs to come to an end. And I think when you see the actions of folks like General Flynn and General McInerney and clearly others who have not represented the armed forces well at all. If you think about, folks like Eddie Gallagher or Clint Lawrence or Robert Bales, who quite frankly, in my opinion, are war criminals. They don't deserve our admiration just because they wore a uniform. And I think that's okay to say to point out some untoward behavior that is not healthy for our democracy is okay. It doesn't mean that we're less patriotic by speaking out against them. And in fact, I would argue it is our patriotic duty to speak out against these veterans who are in cases like McInerney and Flynn, calling for martial law, that it's patriotic to stand up against those and not just blindly accept them because those words are coming from folks who wore our nation's uniform.
I think everybody would probably agree with you that just because you wore the uniform doesn't make you an angel, doesn't make you right on everything you say and do. I don't think everybody would agree with maybe the tone of the article in that the pendulum has shifted from Vietnam where you were baby killers to now you're immediately a hero. Neither one of those are right.
Right, right.
But a lot of that's also the media. I don't know if it's ordinary everyday Americans as much as how it gets played in the media. And I guess I'd like you to think about whether or not the article, which was really directed to a certain class of veterans, and I'll call them the political veteran elite, whether those are the folks you're really talking about that we have to be more critical of, we have to be more focused in on, because I think there's a big difference between those generals who we see planted in various administrations, and every administration's had them since George Washington, right? So we are a nation that has always salted our leadership with this military class. But that doesn't make them any better than the rest of us, I guess would be my argument.
I think that's correct. The problem, though, is I don't think it's just a media construction. I think, when we look at when President Trump first filled his cabinet and there was a lot of discussion, not just from the media, but I think from political commentators and even from President Trump himself, saying that he was bringing in senior military leaders because those were the most trusted Americans. And that's just not healthy for our republic, that if we can't believe that anybody is trustworthy except for military veterans, that's not healthy for our republic. And we saw even, an open letter by colleagues of mine, Paul Yingling and John Nago, who I served alongside, writing an open letter to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, arguing that if President Trump decided not to leave the White House, if he lost the election, this was before the election, that that we would have to call in the military. And so it's not just the media construction, it's folks that are believing that the only trustworthy component of our democracy are military veterans, and that those are the ones that can save us from ourselves. And I just don't think that's a good place for us to be.
How did military leadership get to the point that all these retired guys think they have to weigh in and talk about it? I'll go back to, as somebody who's taught at West Point, is it something that's coming out of the academies that, or is it something in the culture of survival to those ranks that suggests, well, in the end, I know what's right and I'm going to tell you and you better listen to me?
Yeah, I think there might be something to that. I think senior ranking officers get there because they certainly have a type A personality and believe that, given the right resources and the right backing, that they can make the decisions that will be best for the organization. And I think when you kind of expand that out to the country as a whole, that there is a sense that these veterans, based on their experiences both home and overseas, know what's best for the country because of their experiences serving in uniform. And therefore, they feel I guess, a duty and a need to speak out politically. And again, I think, you know, we've seen with cases like General Flynn where that can be taken to a really dangerous extreme, I think. I would argue that if you look at folks like General Mattis or General McMaster, they were serving in the Trump administration because they thought they could do what was right for the country, not just for an administration, but for what was right for the country based on their experiences. And I believe that they were genuine in those beliefs. And there's nothing wrong with that. But again, I think wearing the uniform shouldn't give you that automatic cover.
As you've moved, Colonel, from the East Coast, if you will, of the nation to the West Coast of the nation, I wonder whether some of what you're identifying is sometimes referred to as Potomac fever. Those who stay inside the Beltway feel more righteous, more powerful, and those maybe who are just a little beyond the Beltway, geez, I wish I was in the Beltway, and maybe there's some point at which the gravitational pull breaks apart and you don't worry about this anymore. But again, I'm back to, I think this isn't about regular veterans. I think this is about a certain type or class of veteran, maybe just general officers, maybe it's more than that. But I guess I wonder whether as you've moved further away from the East Coast, have the views changed?
My personal views or just the communities in which I'm in?
Probably the communities and the people who sort of gravitate to this issue of, you know, I know what's best because I served and I had all this experience and you don't.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know if it's a coastal issue or, you know, inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway. Although I did receive quite a number of emails, feedback from veterans themselves who said that they agreed and were shared similar concerns about, you know, this kind of almost warped definition of service and sacrifice that only veterans understand service, only veterans understand sacrifice that you see, not just from senior leaders, but, you know, I had a veteran who reached out to me in Kansas who was concerned about this local, this recent election period. And in local elections, he was seeing signs and TV ads of veterans saying that, you know, they were running and they were the best person to vote for because they had military service. And again, I think when we define service only as military service, that's not healthy for a republic either.
Well, and I don't think you'll ever get away from that. It's an element of somebody's life that they want to promote and they're proud of and they should be. I don't think they should be prohibited from running for office or prohibited from mentioning their background. I do think there's a tipping point, and I think that's where you were trying to head was, rich and like a good author, you've got a good turn of phrase, ritualistic fawning, which are two words I've never seen put together before, did exactly what you wanted it to do, which was trigger a conversation, right?
Yeah, I think so. And we need to have more of it, to be quite frank. I think, you know, part of the problem with this ritualistic fawning is it limits our debate and discussion over some really important matters about civilian control of the military, about what are appropriate military policies overseas, what are the costs of our national security. If you think about it, we really did not have a debate, a healthy debate at all, about our recent defense budget, which was $740 billion. There was no discussion about whether those costs were really going to make us more secure, whether we should or rightful in spending that much money on defense. It was just a matter of, rubber stamping in a sense.
We clearly don't have enough time to talk about the national defense budget and whether or not the dollars or the priorities are anywhere near where they should be.
But I think what it does, though, is it links in, you know, because we're uncomfortable of criticizing veterans, we're then also uncomfortable about criticizing the defense budget. And I think those two are linked, and we need to consider how one leads to into the other.
Well, I as I say, that's a whole topic. I'd love to talk about China and the risks. You know, are we focused on the wrong risks? Right, right, you know, that's a real big issue, it seems to me. But you, as I said, you've had the opportunity to write a number of books, Pulp Vietnam, Westmoreland's War, Withdrawal, No Secure Victory, and the Fighting in the Great Crusade. What's next? Do you have the next manuscript going along here, Colonel Gregory Dennis?
I just finished, as you mentioned, the Pulp Vietnam, which looked at how the militarization of American culture was taking place in the Cold War and how that had an impact on those that were going to Vietnam. And that's just out with Cambridge University Press. And I think what's next is just looking at a larger work that evaluates the United States' relationship with war during the Cold War era and how it was part and parcel of our domestic policy and also our foreign policy and kind of led to where we are today, where I would argue, you know, we very much, unfortunately, have a militarized foreign policy and need to, I think, as with other aspects of this, have more of a debate on that.
Well, I want to thank you for taking some time today to have a thoughtful conversation with Veterans Radio listeners. I think you bring up some good points. We might disagree a little bit about the right. Sharpening the point on the regular veteran versus the political class military officer, but that's okay. That's the whole point of the healthy debate. And I really do appreciate you creating time this afternoon to have this discussion, Greg.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Technician 5th grade Lewis Hall ignored orders to withdraw from his position and continued firing a machine gun until he was killed. Details after this. As leader of a machine gun squad charged with the protection of other battalion units, Hall's group was attacked by a superior number of Japanese. His gunner was killed, his assistant gunner was wounded, and an adjoining gun crew put out of action. Ordered to withdraw from his hazardous position, he refused to retire, but rushed forward to the idle gun. Another soldier joined him and held the machine gun up by the tripod to increase its field of action. Hall opened fire and inflicted heavy casualties upon the enemy. While so engaged, both soldiers were killed, but their sturdy defense was a decisive factor in the following success of the attacking battalion.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We hope you enjoyed the conversation that we had with retired Army Colonel Greg Dattis. The sound quality on the recording platform we used allowed it to be a little too echoey, and we're sorry about that. We'll fix it next time. But I think it was important to hear his views and those of others, obviously, who think maybe we're overdoing this. You served, you're a veteran, and you should have some exalted status, whether you be a member of Congress and get some exalted status because of your veteran's service, or part of that chattering, talking head class that we all see on cable TV and kind of wonder, well, you know, what made you guys such experts? And I do think, as I talked to Professor Dattis a little bit about his writing, that I don't think America fawns enough over its regular veterans. I might agree with him that there's too much fawning on the political military class, but I kind of have a different opinion than him, I think, on whether or not we pay enough attention to or quote-unquote fawn over regular veterans, whether it be in employment or health care or just simply recognition by other citizens that, hey, these guys and gals who put on the uniform is what keeps this country free and keeps us having the liberties and rights and freedoms that we have in this country. Somebody's got to do it. You know, the Greatest Generation, everybody served Vietnam, everybody served because of the draft, or largely everybody served unless they found their way around the draft. That's a whole other question. But this volunteer force is a unique group, and I think an important group to recognize and honor. And we hear it regularly here on Veterans Radio that, you know, maybe the family didn't have a whole lot of military service. Maybe I went into the military because I needed some educational money, or I needed to get out of a bad situation I was at home, or, hey, after high school, what else was I going to do? I I really wasn't focused on a college education or even a trade. It's not about why they went in to serve. It's the fact that they served. It's about really the job that they did, whether it be as simple as being a clerk or as scary as being a SEAL. Not everybody's at the pointy end of the stick, and thank God for that. So I do think this idea that maybe we fawn over people too much is maybe a little bit ridiculous. I know a lot of generals that maybe get too much fawning over, but I'm not so sure it happens in the enlisted ranks. I know a lot of chiefs and master chiefs who don't get enough attention paid to the efforts that they put out in their time of service. So I'd be interested in your ideas and your thoughts. So feel free to contact us, jim@veteransradio.net, or my partner, dale@veteransradio.net. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there as well. On our veteransradio.net site, we have links to our regular podcasts that we put up every week, so I think you might find those of interest. So, again, we appreciate you listening in to Veterans Radio. We appreciate you reaching out to our sponsors and letting them know that you heard about us here. If you've got any program ideas that you want to pass along, Dale and I are always looking for new people to interview, new stories to tell. You know, sometimes it's a little more controversial, like the what's Trump's legacy at the VA? Sometimes it's opinion pieces like, does America fawn over its veterans too much? So a wide range of topics. We're glad that you have listened in on Veterans Radio, and we look forward to being back to you next week. And until then, you are dismissed.
Hi, this is Dale Throneberry from Veterans Radio, and here with a little special add-on to today's program. Many of you have asked where our theme came from. Well, the theme song for Veterans Radio is entitled The Spirit of Corps, and it was written by Robert Yeager and performed by the United States Marine Band. And so we wanted to play the whole thing for you today, and so here we go.